Welcome to the premiere episode of Two Nerds and an Actor and Guest. This podcast will still be talking about the TV, movies, and entertainment we blurreds love, but this time with the creators themselves. And I'm your host, Aisha Jordan, here with my nerdiest co-host, France Jerome.
France, anime, me, the guy, anime glasses. Cling. France Jerome.
Anime glasses.
Yeah, you know when you hit the glasses and then all of a sudden you can't see your eyes, just the light on the glasses?
Oh, that means we need sounds like that. To be like, France, Jerome. Yeah. Okay. Got it. Well, I'm very excited for this to be our first ever episode where we are interviewing people. How are you feeling about it, France?
Oh, it's good. It's good. I wanted to get into the minds of some of the creators that we've been spending all these years talking about. Hyped.
That is very true. We always talk about people, but we're never like with the peoples. So I'm really excited. We have, like, really cool people coming up.
Word.
But before we get into that, what are you watching right now, France?
I ran through Megalobox Season 2.
This is Megalobox.
Megalobots.
Yeah,
Megalobox.
Not Megalobox.
Like boxing. Yeah. Megalobox.
If you guys know France, you know he's, like, a Transformers super fan.
Yes.
But this is not Megalobots.
Yes, no,
some
Megalo.
Some, like, offshoot of Transformers.
Yeah, it's, that would be the dollar store version. We're not doing that. We're not doing that. This is Megalobox. It is a super dope anime. Like, the first season really dealt with, like, citizenship and, like, legitimacy in a really dope way. But then this one opened the representation gates, kind of, and is really about immigration and what it means to be nomadic and about what are borders type stuff, and a lot of boxing, good clean animation. Like, it's a vibe. Soundtrack is crazy.
Leave it to France to find the social justice boxing anime.
There's always a lens.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I don't know, woke people can't go on vacation.
Nope. Megalo woke.
For anyone who doesn't know, that's one of my sayings, that woke people can't go on vacation. And that is based off of all my woke peoples that I go on vacation with. And everything upsets them.
Excuse me, ma'am. Is the pineapple from this pina colada locally sourced? Is it sustainable?
But that's not to say we shouldn't care about things while we're on vacation. But I'm always like, oh, okay, yes, that white lady is annoying. Can we ignore her? Let's just move on and enjoy our vacation.
No. She said, no, no, no.
So aren't you going to ask me what I'm watching, France?
We live in the same house, but yeah, I bet. So Aisha, what are you watching?
So I just want to preface this that I'm trying to watch this because France isn't watching it. And that's just because I want to watch things when I want to watch them sometimes. And if I have to wait for France for the next episode, like, you know what I mean? I'm not going to watch, like, Andor without him. Do you know what I mean? But if there is a show that, oh yeah, and those for you who are new to this, France and I are married. And that is why I'm talking about watching shows with him.
Mm-hmm.
And if you feel the same way, let us know, because there are times when partners go out and they see things without the other partner and people get upset. Like, people are pissed.
Yeah, I've seen some arguments over Twitter about.
Yeah. Like, I think I was having a conversation with someone once that was like, that's like a breakupable offense.
Yikes.
And I'm like, wow. Anyway, point is, I am watching Yellow Jackets without France.
Right.
Now. Yeah, right now I'm watching it without him, but I know that he's going to want to watch it.
You want me to watch it?
Because it is a really good show. Yeah.
You really want me to watch it, but...
I do. I'm already like 3 episodes in or something like that, but I don't mind going back and starting again. Although now I've lost a show that I can watch on my own, but there's plenty of other ones.
It's not. You can still do it, but I mean, so what's so enticing about Yellow Jackets?
Okay, Yellow Jackets is a story... All ladies, right? All lady cast. Ooh. It's a girls soccer team, high school, that is going on a championship game or something like that. I can't remember right now. But they're going away on a plane and there's a plane crash. So the episode actually goes through the time of the plane crash and then as they're older adults afterwards. And it's kind of going through like how they deal with what happened in the crash. So one of the things that's really awesome is the casting. Like each one-to-one match of their high school self and their older self is like really on point. And then there's like Christina Ricci's in it, which that one is a little different. So like she's not the Christina Ricci that we all know. And I feel like if you're like us 80s babies growing up in the 90s, you remember Christina Ricci like Addams Family. You remember what? Casper.
Oh my
you remember
God.
Sleepy Hollow.
Yeah.
That's the Christina Ricci. Also, for those deep dive ones, she was in Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas.
Yeah.
Like, you never remember much about that movie, but randomly, Christina Ricci's in that movie. But yeah, she's not like her kind of brooding self. And they kind of had to make her look like the younger one. I don't know. You got to watch it. When you see it, you'll see.
It's hard for me not to watch things with Christina Ricci in it. So you got me. All right. I'm intrigued. All right. I'll do it.
But speaking of all ladies, this show that we're about to talk about with our amazing guest is all basically lady, black lady led.
Black lady led.
But written by a black man.
Ooh.
And we actually get into that in the conversation. So very excited. Sticking up for ladies. We have the writer and executive producer of the new Octavia Butler TV series, Kindred.
Yeah.
Back
on the building.
First look.
Yes.
Great news. It's Brandon Jacobs Jenkins is a friend of ours. So it was really, really fun to reconnect with him. But if you don't know him, tell him about him, France.
Word. So listen, if y'all don't know, so tonight's episode's guest is a legit contemporary luminary in the theater world. Got plays up all over the country. Definitely an edgy and unapologetic black voice in any medium that he's working in. Just so y'all know, he's that guy. The resume is crazy. Neighbors and Octoroon, War, Appropriate, Gloria for my theater heads. And for my nerdy heads, did work on HBO's Watchmen. And like Aisha just said, writing and executive producing on Kindred. Welcome to the podcast, Brandon Jacobs. Jenkins, fanfare.
All right. So... thank you, Brandon, for coming to speak with us today. It's lovely to see you.
Seriously, thank you guys. This is like the greatest blast from my past in recent memory. Seriously.
For listeners, Brandon and France and I go way back to 2008.
Oh, my God.
Oh, no. Maybe we should cut that out because I'm aging us.
That's a really long time. That's wild.
When we were with the Emerge NYC program. So shout out to that.
Mm-hmm.
And we're so excited to reconnect, especially because you've been doing some amazing, amazing things. And I do want to point out, we saw your name on the Watchmen television show.
Uh-oh.
We saw your name pop up, Francie.
Because that's like the beginning of how this journey starts, is we're at Comic-Con, we're pressed with Black Nerd Problems, we come through, we're sitting, we're blown away by this Tulsa, Oklahoma, we're sitting and looking at each other talking about, yo, whoever did the dramaturgy on this is...
L-O-L.
A+. And then your name pops up in bright yellow, we both look at each other like...
I was like, of course.
Uh-huh. That is stupid. Y'all are stupid. Yeah.
Can you talk about that a little bit? What was it like? How did you get involved with Watchmen and what were you working on with them?
Man. God, I mean, that was so long ago. I mean, I had just, I've been doing like all this secret like work for HBO for a while. And then I finally like sold my pitch for Kindred. And it was like very soon after like this one last hurrah, HBO called me up and was like, would you like to meet on The Watchmen? Damon Lindelof's doing adaptation. And I was like, of course. I mean, I'm obsessed with, I mean, literally it's like number one, Octavia Butler, number two, Toni Morrison, number three, Alan Moore. Like That's just like my trifecta. And I am obsessed with Watchmen, like obsessed. Was obsessed, still kind of am obsessed. And I was like, of course. And I think I happened to be in LA randomly. And I was like, let me just drive down here and meet Damon Lindelof. And he very instantly, I think he was like shocked that I was a super fan. And he realized that like, he was like, he basically eventually was like, you are almost as big of a fan of this book as I am. And I was like, well, actually I might be more of a fan than you are, but I'm gonna let you have that because you're the showrunner. And, but during the meeting, you know, we were just geeking out about it. And he, and I really couldn't do it because I was like teaching at Hunter at the time in New York. And I was like, there's no way to make this work unless I'm like flying, literally flying back and forth every week to do this job. But he said to me, there's this fan theory that Hooded Justice is black. And I want to see if it has legs. And I thought to myself, I've never heard this fan theory. I was like, what? And he walked me through it. And I was like, okay, this is actually like my actual shit. Like, this is like, I, you know, cause I, you know, I had never thought about that. And I heard, when I heard the theories, I was like, I bet that if there's a way to make this work, I will, like, you know, Alan Moore will be just the beast to end all beasts. Like, I just couldn't believe that that was really like, cause that book, that, that comic is so dense. And there's just like, it's sort of like Octavia's work where like you more, you just, it's clear that this was like a mastermind at work. And the more you go back to it, the layers and layers that kind of reveal themselves and like the amount of just detail and how much like every little chamber of this cathedral is like thought through. And I was like, you know, Damon really got me with that. I was like, okay, this is like actually kind of challenge I'm interested in. And I joined the room and it was like very difficult because I was literally flying back and forth every single week. I was on like a 7 a.m. flight on Tuesdays, getting into the room halfway through, leaving on like the Friday red eye. But that's how much I just loved this book and trying to crack this code. And, you know, I would say that, like, the majority of my energy was spent trying to figure out the Hooded Justice of it all. I mean, there's some, like, hilarious things that I pitched that got in, like, Skip Gates being, in charge of, like, like all this, like, silly stuff. But I also was very much interested in, you know, well, I'll say that the big aha moment for me was this... One weekend, I was like, it was very hard room. I'm sure you've read, like, it was, you know, if you read about it, it was very, very difficult room. Went on for a super long time. And a lot of sensitive shit came up. It was like variant stuff came up. It was very insane. But I remember one weekend being like, let me take this comic book home and like reread it. And I want to circle every single instance of blackness that's either mentioned or depicted, meaning I went through every frame, I circled every black face, I circled every, like, every single mention. And I had this realization that even though this was an alt history, it was not an alt history for black people. Like, black people in this world have right. The same exact history as they do in our world. And I was like, that's an interesting thing to... Because ultimately, the Watchmen aren't interested in black life. And right. The Watchmen are... And it's, you know, the threads are there. Like, you know, you have Rorschach, who's essentially, like, what we would think of as, like, an alt-right monster now. And anyway, but it was just... that, like, I think unlocked something in terms of that broader thematic. And I also, you know, I think he was like, what would be, like, the actual biography of this Hooded Justice that we're dreaming about? And I was like, well, he'd probably been... Probably would have been a veteran. Like, he probably would have done this, and that would have brought him here. And it was just fun to, like, figure that out. Like, to really, like, yeah. I mean, we were literally, like, looking at the scripts. I remember there's another big aha moment because there's one frame where Hooded Justice has, you know, you see his flesh through his eye holes. And there's a lot of debates about that. And I was like, because they were like, can we actually make him black with this frame in existence? Right. And I was like, you can if you look at Alan Moore's scripts, because if Alan Moore in that script does not depict or describe Hooded Justice's skin tone, you can attribute that to a choice by Dave Gibbons and thus argue that's, you know, and of course he went back and found the scripts and we had that like weigh in. And that was like, and we were kind of off to the races. So that was really the, honestly, so I'm really only, my name is only on the episodes that are Hooded Justice related because I wound up having to like leave the room for like personal stuff. But it was wild. And like, I didn't know what was going to happen because that room went on and on and on. And like, you know, near, you know, once they'd finished kind of breaking that whole story and they'd shot the show and it was still sort of like this wild thing no one quite knew what to do with, you know, Damon circled back and it was just interesting to like see how far they'd gone down the road and then to like see it on the air and watch the world kind of react to it. Because I think we were like, we felt like we were being so crazy in that room. Like we were just like, we have no idea people are going to even give a crap about any of this. But you know, that show wound like changing history books for people and like
changed my life.
Yeah, as a profound like example of what that form at its best can ultimately do. In addition to entertaining, right? It can be, it can really kind of lead to transformations and the way we talk about history and in the form. You know, so
yeah.
It was, that's a long-winded way of saying, like, I just nerded out, and you know.
Aisha bought me Watching the Watchmen for Christmas a few years back, and I voraciously read that once or twice, just, like, to get through, to hear you ground some of the stuff. I feel like, I mean, to be really real, yes, you brought that to the table. Alan Moore's kind of, and he's an anarchist, and for him to bring, so he just kind of stirs the pot and lets it sit. And so, if you were to pick that up and ground it, watching the show, I was, it did what it was supposed to do. You did what needed to be done.
Hey, I'll take it. I mean, I literally felt like I was just trying to like be the biggest fan ever because it was truly like for me, it was like he's such a Alan Moore's such a storyteller. Like he leaves all the pieces in front of you, and you just have to kind of like. Just move them an inch closer together and you start to see the picture he's gesturing at. Because, you know, race is all over that book, which is to say, like, blackness is all over that book and anti-blackness is all over that book.
Yeah.
And no, but like, no one had ever given space to... those things were just kind of glossed over, right? Yeah. They were never really... No one really wanted to stare those things in the face, but it's a huge part of, you know, whiteness. It is about whiteness, you know? Absolutely. The Watchmen, watch out for everyone but... Again, the black folks in that world. Yeah.
Right, what you know.
Hey.
So, on that tip, I'm guessing you consider yourself a nerd?
Of course, extremis. You look at me. Literally look at me. Ask anyone who has ever met me. Listen to the sound of my voice. Listen to the timbre of my voice. Get out of here. Of course.
That's one one of the things that I like to bring up because in the world of nerd, I think it can be very exclusionary, right? It's like if you didn't read this issue, if you didn't do that, if you don't know about this, you can't be a part of it. And kind of part of this podcast is to show like we're all nerds in our own right. And it doesn't matter if you know a million things or you know that one thing, like you're a part of this culture with this. And obviously because black people have been kind of pushed out of nerddom, even though we've always existed. And then now, you know, even with you talking about Watchmen and bringing out the blackness that was already in there is like phenomenal to me. That's something that I think, you're like laughing, France, I can see that.
Yes, no, it's because the fan theory was more of a, that the whole that like the story of the fan theory around Hooded Justice being black was more about people being like, they wanted him to be black. It just made sense. And it created all this kind of... Just the idea of it created so much controversy that it kind of gave it life to itself in that way in the zeitgeist. So it was super dope to see. But then thinking about how nerddom manifests. How black, how blurredom manifests.
Facts.
I hear that.
And to see you... And for you to be the bridge to bring that across the mediums... was like it was profound for me, and you will never know, you yourself may not ever know what it was to sit there and see it in that way so removed from it and then to become instantly connected to it, not just because we know each other, but because we were sitting there like, yo, who did this,
you know what? That's it is funny. Too, it's like because we know like your mind, do you know what I mean? It was like as soon as I saw your name I was like, yes, absolutely. He did things that were brilliant that no one thought of, even though it's always been there. Do you know what I mean? Like, I know that's kind of how you work and you can just blow bites, which kind of segues. We're going to get into Kindred because obviously that's
take
the biggest
your time.
Thing.
Take your time. And
like mind blowing that we're finally getting Octavia Butler, you know,
totally.
On any type of screen. But before we get into, I kind of want to talk about the fact that you've been, I would say, somewhat of like a mogul in theater for a long time now. So what was it like jumping from theater to the TV world? Is that something you always wanted to do? You were like, you know what, I'm going to do this theater thing, but I'm going to jump to TV.
That's funny. I mean, no, actually, like I have never wanted to make a play more than in the past, like 2 years of my life. I would say that COVID definitely helped me make that leap because there was no theater to do. And I was like, well, I guess I'll just sit here and try to get these people to make this show I've been trying to make. I mean, ironically, the only show I've ever been interested in making is Kindred, you know, like, because for so long, all this stuff I was doing TV stuff to like survive. Like, it's how I held health insurance. And every playwright I know ultimately did some version of that because, as we know, playwriting does not come with health insurance or much money to, for that matter. And, you know, I think The Watchmen was just like a fluke because I loved that book. It just like, you know, it just kind of like, it was immediately a thing. But yeah, I guess like, you know, TV is like such a fluid thing right now. I mean, what it was when I started doing it versus what it is now, wildly different. Like the idea of like when we sold Kindred in 2016, like, we did not think we would be streaming. We didn't know what streaming was, you know, like, and here we are dropping every episode on a Tuesday. Like, you know, there's just, it's just like hard to even say like, oh, I dreamed of this. Cause I think no one saw what this form is coming, you know, whereas theater is ultimately always what it's going to be, which is like, you know,
that's why it's
a bunch
there.
Of like, it's why it's there. It's like thousands of years old. Yeah. So we do the same thing. We just get people in the room and like memorize lines and try to make them sound good, you know, every night for like 6 weeks, you know? So, but it's been, and it's interesting how oddly enough, like theater probably prepared me the most for television, though I guess it remains to be said like what television has given me to bring back to the theater. But, you know, it didn't feel like such of a leap because you're still talking to actors, you're still designing sets, you're still designing costumes. It just happens that your canvas is like 8 hours and you only get to make things 5 minutes at a time, you know?
Wow.
But yeah. That's the only real difference. You know, I also would say that there's been in the last 5-10 years like an unprecedented amount of playwrights who like have made the transition or do both, and I was able to call a lot of them up and ask for advice like over and over again. And so in some ways it's hard to really distinguish those two practices now, I think, for a good amount of people who practice. Yeah.
Okay. I love it. I myself trying to get in that world, TV writing. I don't know how it works, but I know as a producer how that works, so.
It's not, well, you'd be, I was going to say, you, first of all, the way people wind up in TV is so different. You just kind of have to start writing. There's like a million, you know, ways in the door, I would say.
Well, I have my web series, so I'm starting there, and we'll see what happens from there.
Good.
But let's get into Kindred.
Yes, of course.
So for those who don't know, which would be weird, if you're listening to this podcast, you probably know who Octavia Butler is, to be honest. But if you don't, amazing, amazing, amazing writer that I would say was one of the first times a lot of Black people understood what like Afrofuturism is and how they could see themselves in the future, whether it was dystopian or not. It was like, oh, yeah, we existed then, we exist now, we can exist in the future. That's real life. So, yeah, and this is the first time, if I'm not, you know, wrong.
Oh, no, you're absolutely correct.
Okay, that we're seeing Octavia Butler be adapted into something
it's
for
crazy.
TV. I think there was, like, a musical once that went to Joe's Pub.
There was, Toshi Reagan.
It was, her Parable, which still is around. It's still touring.
Oh, yes, I did not
my
know
friend
that.
Eric is very involved in that. Yeah. And, you know, someone told me there was, like, an audio play adaptation of Kindred in, like, the 90s.
What?
Yeah. Someone dug it up for me and shared it with me, but I did not. I couldn't get past the, you know, it was too close to home. You know,
that's a tough one to make into an audio play.
Yeah.
Anyways. Point is, Kindred. So we were able to watch at least the first 3 episodes, which, I know, very exciting. And I, for one, am very interested in how you were able to bring this from, you know, the book to a screenplay, and what you decided to keep and what you decided to leave out, and kind of that kind of process in writing.
Yeah. I mean, speaking of the theater, like, you know, I think a good chunk of my, like, practice there has been rooted in, like, adaptation or, like, quote-unquote, like, radical adaptation. And for me, it's not about creating, like, a word-for-word, beat-for-beat carbon copy of something, but actually trying to, like, find its, you know, because a book is not a TV show. You know, a novel's not a TV show, so the forms do different things. And it's basically trying to, like, find the iteration of it that best lives in this other form, you know? Mm. And that is often about, like, making sure that I definitely adapt the spirit of the book, but not necessarily the, like, exact details of it. Right. Partly because, you know, the book is written first person, and it's set in the 70s, and, you know, there's just things I, like, didn't want to have, like, voiceover, you know, I didn't want to... I think part of the book too is like she's a writer, and the book itself, you realize, is the her first book that she's writing. And I'm like, well, that isn't quite true. You know, I don't want to see someone writing a book. That's just like not interesting to me. So, and I also wanted to, I had this very strong impulse early on, and the estate actually really affirmed this, to set it in a more contemporary time, because I felt like, you know, she, I basically want to like honor everything she was, her, all of her impulses. I was like, she was writing this, setting it in a recent past for her contemporary audience. And I was like, she didn't know the future. She didn't know that in like 45 years, someone would make a TV show out of this. She didn't know it'd be like, no, come go down to history as one of her most, like her best selling novel, basically, and most taught, widely taught novel. But I just wanted to not make something that felt like a museum piece or like, you know, you could hold it at a remove, because then somehow that would like neuter the kind of radical ideas inside of what she was doing for me.
Right.
And so that was the, that early choice. And again, her estate, like I remember Merle Heifetz, who was her literary executor, was like, Octavia would have wanted you to make the thing for now. And I was like, okay, that's all I got to hear, you know? And so
that's fair.
Every other choice kind of had to, account for that bigger choice. So suddenly you're asking things like, well, she has a cell phone and she has Google. So she, you know, so she's not relying on these like dusty fusty books that she has in her house to solve all her problems. And like, also, can she really afford a house in Pasadena or LA now? And like, what does the creative class look like now? And like, what does courtship look like now? What does marriage mean now? You know, and those things ultimately kind of, again, everything we tried to do was like in the grain of her ideas and her original text, but it wasn't always exactly that thing, you know? And it was a really long process. I mean, we sold the pitch in 2016, and obviously we're only coming to the air in 2022. So that is a good 6 years of like notes and drafts and like, you know, again, it's the theater, at least like you kind of own, you know, you're the author, you own the scripts, but in TV, you're like trying to just like run this thing, it's, you know, until you get caught. And it, you know, there's the development process, they call it development, and there was just a lot of things that we, a lot of lessons we learned along the way, a lot of battles that were fought and lost, while some fat battles were fought and won. And but ultimately you kind of sort of have to stand behind what you get to, you know, when it comes to the adaptation itself.
France, you wanted to
go so on for me, the question becomes, similarly with Washington, why Kindred? Why this story in particular?
Yeah.
And I was about to ask you why 2016. You kind of answered a little bit. I just know 2016 to be a very inflammatory year. but yeah.
Why Kindred? I mean, I would say they're related conversations. You know, I think why not Kindred? It's a classic book. The themes are evergreen. You know, for me, I'm like, you know, you guys know some of my work in the theater, like slavery and how it like lives is like the creative material of my life. And I just was like, why not try to like work that out on this larger scale ultimately? But also, I would say 2016 was the beginning of a backslide, right? And I think the kind of metaphor at the heart of this book really resonated for people very differently. I mean, it's like it's no surprise to me that she's like, that Octavia Butler's mainstream the way she has in the last 6 years, because, you know, they always said she was like ahead of her time, and I feel like we're now at that time that she was ahead of.
Right.
You know? So all her books are like snatched up. Everyone's trying to develop everything into a TV show. And I'm like, well, let's see what she's really talking about, you know? But I would say that, like, you know, Kindred asks very important questions of all the folks about what resistance looks like, right? And what survival looks like, because, you know, people took to the streets in these last 2 years, but what did those streets yield is a big question. And who didn't take the streets? And, like,
right,
you know, ultimately this is a story about a woman who is coming to terms with herself as, you know, morally compromised. She is the product of more than melodrama. She's got all kinds of blood in her veins, and she has to understand, like, where am I willing to sacrifice myself, and what kind of corners am I willing to cut in order to survive? And I think those are, like, very vivid questions for everyone, especially during the pandemic. Absolutely. But definitely, like, you know, the era right before, in my opinion.
I mean, there's a lot of evidence to suggest.
Listen, we're just doing detective work, you know. Yeah, yeah.
Did you, because doing an adaptation of Octavia Butler is kind of really charged, right? So you have a lot of people who have a lot of expectations on how it's going to be. How was that for you? Did you feel pressured to do it and do it well? And kind of how did you mitigate that?
Of course. I mean, because the truth is, if I were not adapting this, I would be one of those people who was like, what you doing? Who you think you are? What's happening? You know? And I still am. I mean, that inner critic has been alongside me the whole time. And I just honestly, whenever I felt that pressure, I would just return to the text. I would go like, okay, let me center myself in the book. Like, what is the book trying to do? What is she trying to do? You know? Mm. And how do I kind of, again, make sure that whatever I'm doing feels in the service of this idea, or feels like a rhyme or an echo of that idea, you know, because that's all you can do. I mean, people are just going to have opinions.
Absolutely.
You know what I'm saying?
Oh, like, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
And, you know, there was not a day that went by where I didn't wake up and go, oh my God, I cannot believe I'm the one who gets to do this. Like that, you know, it just felt crazy. It still feels
dreams
crazy.
Dreams do come
you know?
True.
I guess dreams do come true, you know, but I do also hope people just, you know, trust the, I don't know, love I have for the obsession I have, but also that there is like a master plan to it, right? Like the writers and I all kind of have these bigger dreams about it, and you only get 8 hours to play with in the first iteration, right? That's a thing. Yeah.
So my claim to fame is that I've read every Octavia Butler book.
Okay.
And I didn't.
That's your claim to fame, though.
Say, he
on.
Does this a lot.
I feel like
he's
got
like
a lot
the encyclopedia.
Going on.
I got a lot of claims.
Ooh.
That's my nerd. But I read them across the breadth of, like, from my adolescence through to my early adulthood. I didn't know I was reading all of them. I just found Wild Seed one day, and that was it. It was on.
Yes. That's so crazy. That's also my first book. That was my gateway book.
Look at, yeah, yo.
I mean, the Patternist books are still my, like, the ones that live closest to my heart, because those are the ones I got really, really deep into.
Lilith's
really
Brew
early.
Took me. Lilith's Brew took me somewhere. And because I think I know we're a little tangential here.
I was going to say, nerds. I had to say.
But my initial understandings around Black feminism and Black, like, womanism came from, and without ever saying it.
Yes.
But it was there. And I start to understand the women in my life so much differently after reading those books. I was like, holy smokes.
So it should be required reading for young boys. Is that what you're telling me?
It kind
Absolutely.
Of should.
That okay. and Bell Hooks. Gotcha. Go get it.
Oh, well,
go
yes.
get it. Gotcha. And Ted Morrison, but
I think I had a question, but I got caught up in the sweep of that.
No, you're saying your claim to fame, you're a completist.
Oh, yes. This one attacked, or came to you, spoke to you. Kindred was the story you wanted to tell. Which story do you believe of hers? Do you Octavia Butler's? Let me speak her name. Which book of Octavia Butler's do you think is most apt for right now?
For this moment? Most apt. I mean, you know, the parable book. I mean, the parable books are the most, like, it feels like she found our letters and read each one out loud. You know, that's the one that feels the most like one-to-one in that way. But in terms of, like, I mean, when you say apt, do you mean like the thing that we need right now, or?
That's actually a great model. That's a great, like, modification to it.
Because I often think about, like, she has this story called The Book of Martha, which I love. Mm. And I'm always like, everybody just needs to read this story, you know?
You heard it here first of all. Yeah, I heard it. Read the book. Read the story.
Read the story. Yeah. But that's to me is like the key to her whole scripture, you know, is in that story. But what would you say to that? I mean, what would your answer be?
Oh, if I'm being, I'm an Aquarius. So God, forgive me. I really go for the.
I love Aquariuses. My daughter's an Aquarius. Oh, yeah.
Also, I want, like, I know this, we'll probably cut this out, but okay, we need to talk about the fact that you have kids, but yeah. Back to hey, answer yeah. the question.
Not multiple. Okay. Just one. Yeah.
Well, I think it might be Clay's Ark.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Which, and it's only because that feeling of being an outsider that kind of just is pervasive through that book, and I feel like everyone right now, post-official pandemic, feels... like an outsider again, like we're relearning. So, like, it's like,
parts of the and that kind of atmosphere of like paranoia and, you know, wanting to trust people, but you can't. Yeah, I feel that.
Love it. I have not read all of Octavia Butler's things, so I really need to brush up now because these all sound. What am I doing with my time?
I mean, just wait for they're literally all under option. Like, just wait.
Yeah, I'm saying it's a race now.
Right? Just wait for the Renaissance, you know. This flourishing of film and TV adaptations.
Can't wait. Well, this has been so phenomenal talking to you about Kindred.
Wait, is it over?
I only have 30 minutes. I mean, I could keep going. I don't want to take your time up.
Oh, man. How about 5 more minutes? I didn't answer all the questions.
No, yeah. I mean, I could do 5 more minutes. If you have more time.
Let's do 5 more minutes.
I was trying to be more respectful of your time.
We out here. Let's get it. We outside.
I'm sorry. Let's do part two. Like, what's happening?
Catch us on the next episode with Brandon.
Oh, man.
Well, one of the things I was interested in as I was watching was the relationship between Dana and her mom. Because I feel like that is a new thing that was not in it. And so I'm curious to see, like, what went into that decision and, like, how did you bring that to fruition?
Well, you know what it is that, so, you know, originally she conceived of Kindred as part of the Patternus series. So Dana was one of Dora's descendants.
Okay.
Yes. And so, but then this thing happened where there's actually a letter where she's like, I think this might actually be like my crossover book, where she decided to like make it a standalone. And one of the, I think that's partly why she sort of like made Dana an orphan, you know? I remember someone saying something like or reading somewhere where she said like it had something to do with like Superman or something. Like, she was interested in how Clark Kent didn't have kids. Anyway. But, but it was interesting because I was like, oh, there was an impulse. You know, those Patternus books are all about inheritance, genealogy, like what it is to be gifted, what it is to be like, you know, born of both like oppressor and oppressed. I mean, it's very, you know, very, very clearly like she's obsessed with like family and in those books. I mean, you know, the book's called Kindred. Mm-hmm. And I also early on spent time with her papers in Huntington. I was like reading all these other drafts and like these false starts. And there was this mother figure who... what showed up in some of these drafts, and I was like, okay, so I just was like, something about this feels like there's an opportunity here, basically. And I really wanted to give, basically, you know, just on a technical level, it gives Dana a bit more emotional dimension to have like another familiar relationship to like process. But really also, speaking of like, you know, she was a pioneer of like ultimately like Black feminist thought before the word for it exists. I wanted to, in fact, in honor of the fact that the book was like 45 years old, I wanted to like not ignore the fact that like after this, there's an incredible explosion in like multiple iterations of like black femalehood and womanhood. And I wanted to somehow create a situation in the show where you could put those things in tension or put those things in conversation. So, you know, we're thinking about, so Olivia, her mother, is technically coming out of like a crack epidemic Brooklyn, like welfare mother, welfare queen moment where like black womanhood is like definitely under attack by the Reagan years and by like, you know, she's living under a different notion of what her obligations and purposes are as a person on the planet. And I just wanted to put that intention with this Dana, who is like definitely Generation Z, you know, feeling entitled, feeling, you know, the house that Terry McMillan built,
Like selling economic independence,
literally just like feeling her independence and feeling her access and privilege in these Obama years. And I don't know, I just, that was just very delicious to me, that idea I could put these people in conversation with each other and even kind of explore other generations as we kind of evolve through the story, you know. So that was really what it came from. And also, I think, you know, in the book, they never address what's happening to her. And that's part of what kind of elevates it and takes into this kind of realm of poetry or allegory. But I feel like that's harder to sustain in television because you're really asking people to live with you for hours and hours and hours. Mm-hmm. And they can't get tired of that question, you know. And I was like, there's something about this that allows us to like build out the metaphor, but also really build out the mythology in the way that you expect from a kind of speculative show in that way. Mm-hmm. So she's sort of our like key to that, hopefully.
And that's literally what we were saying. So we were like watching it, like, what was this decision to have them? I like it because it also gives this element of like mystery, like an added mystery to it, where it's like, why can they both do it? Why did she get stuck? Well, you know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And then France was saying like, also she's like the anchor. You know what I mean? Like she's her anchor in this whole situation.
I think she's the anchor for the viewer.
Exactly. Yeah.
Because we don't know what's happening in that time. And I remember in the book being like, not knowing about what was happening in that time was cute. But watching it, I was like, but what happened these last 10 years? What happened?
That's what we said. We're like, now for just seeing, and that's the thing that goes with an adaptation, right? So you're going from the book to the TV, and it's like, you really need to have something that makes this, not makes it like TV, but makes it for a watcher. You know what I mean? Like, I'm watching this. How am I understanding it? I'm not reading it. I'm not in minds. I'm not in thoughts. You know, I'm not making these things up. And it's like, how do you, again, ground the watcher and pull them in a different way than a book can? And I think that was an expert way to do it. I loved that.
I thought people wouldn't really come for me for that. But people are really coming at me for, like, them not being married, which I'm interested in.
That's what I was going to ask as well. Well, okay. This is how
it's interesting. I'm like really shook a little bit, but I'm interested. I'm interested in it, obviously, because I'm a fan. I'm like, I want to have these fan conversations. Yeah.
So I was like, oh, that interesting. Them not being married. One, because you said early in the conversation about millennial life and things like that, and it's like that. I feel like is an important part to the story and their relationship too, where it's like the idea of dating and all that and what you go through and what you don't go with them, and you could just like ignore them. But if you get thrown in a situation where you're hurtled through time, you are getting to know each other in a way different way.
Yeah, especially because you're spending all this time with somebody, but every time you come back to the present, it's like the same night you met. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
How you make a situationship through time?
It's so funny you say that. We literally would call that in the room. We called it a situationship. Yes. That is hilarious. Yes. It was too funny. You're in the wavelength, Franz. You're feeling it.
The ultimate situationship. Like, this is the situation.
Yes.
I will say, the nerd, like, so my uber extra nerd vibe was, once you introduce you know, the mother, I was like, this is like high key, low key X-Men vibes. And I'm gonna let it live. I'm gonna let it sit, because that's what that's all about, really, is in the same way. It's about, and only the mother can pass on the X gene.
Okay.
So I was just sitting there.
You
like,
are looking to the side, Brandon. What is happening here?
It's crazy.
I mean, first of all, I love the X-Men. I mean, X-Men is like the key to my like life, I think.
Yeah.
But all I'm trying to do in my life is just be the X-Men, create the X-Men,
join
the X-Men.
I named my dog Rogue. I just want to.
Hey, I mean, I think I love that. I mean, you know, you're building out a mythology. And like X-Men is like one of the crazy, I mean, the Marvel universe is just like truly, right, you know, the pinnacle of, you know, universe building and mythology breaking. But yeah, I mean, that's, we're going to try to get it. We're going to hopefully, you know, you got to get people to watch this show so we can get our second season going. But like, you know, we want to talk about sort of, obviously, I think, I mean, I don't want to spoil anything, but like, you know, it seems to be that she's tethered to this male relative, but the power comes from her mother. So what does that mean? Like, what are we, and there's sort of hints that Dana comes from this long line of women who walk out on their kids, lose their minds. And it's like, how does she break this cycle ultimately? Right. Mm-hmm. What is this power or this curse trying to teach her or teach? And why is it landing on women? I mean, that's that's a big question, right?
I literally said, I was like, what is up with a power that like hurdles you back to slavery times? That freaking, come on, what?
Well,
you,
I think
and
in this
you don't
world,
know how to control it yet?
Right, but I think in this world, it's not implied that it necessarily brings you back to slavery time. It just brings you back to a certain relative on your tree. And that relative can be, her relatives happen to be just in the very worst time you want.
Yeah,
you need your relatives to be. If you were a black woman, you're like, could you not have chosen like Hawaii?
Listen, you Mercury know? Was in retrograde when she got her powers. It just didn't work out the way
stuff,
you wanted it to.
But that stuff is kind of in the book. Like, if you really be, again, like, you know, speak about Mike Alan Moore, like, the more I read, I mean, now I've read Kindred like 4 trillion times and listened to the audiobook like 4 trillion
also,
times.
Also, I want that number 4 trillion. That's,
yes, you know, I feel like you begin to sense that she had a kind of math she was working out about, you know, what this was and why it was happening. So, yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
This is Francis' thinking face that he's like, okay, let me put these dots together first, and then.
Yes, because my mind is blown, and I came in with a plan, and then it's like, but this is just so fascinating, and I think I'm super drawn to this idea, and it was you know, Trevor Noah just left The Daily Show, and his last words, were, because you know he's technically emigrating here. From South Africa, and he's like, he just wanted to give a shout out to black women who have been, it was almost like he repeated Malcolm X's quote, but he was just kind of like, you know, they felt the brunt of everything, and they're the folks you like who have to, who don't need to, but are forced to fuck around and find out.
Right.
And I just wanted to ask you, what is it like to write for this woman in particular?
Dana or Olivia?
Dana is the main character, yeah.
Yeah. It's a lot. You know, I feel like I'm like hyper aware of my like cis male identified ass, like trying to be out here talking through some black femalehood, but I also was like purely raised by black women. Like, I think, and I care so much about the black woman in my life. I'm raising a black woman, you know, I've been teaching now for a very long time, and I've been so inspired by my black female students, and there's just a different engagement with the world that they have to sustain, and I just respect that so much. And I think for me, I really just lock into Dana as, I mean, it's how I felt when I read the first book the first time. I was like, it was the first time I read a book where I was like, oh, this is about me. This is me. Like, I am Dana. I'm an aspiring writer. I have white ancestry. I have black ancestry. I have these complicated relationships to my intelligence, to my ambition. You know, I'm pretty much an introvert, you know, and I kind of don't care what nobody thinks about me. I have dated the Caucasians in the past. I'm not married to one, but you know, that's not anyone's fault but mine. You know, I just felt like she embodied for me. It's funny because I don't think of her as hyper feminine or hyper womanist, and like, because in some ways Octavia was. I mean, I remember her, I don't know if I'm supposed to ever let this slip, but her agent Marilee would say to me, like, I would always ask Octavia to write a memoir, and she would say, I already did that. It's called Kindred.
Oh.
And, right? And there's something about that, because, you know, Octavia identified as asexual. you know, and she wore her hair short. In some ways, we would just call her queer. I mean, she just is a queer person in a non-normative sense. And there's something about Dana that is essentially questioning and non-normative. And that's how I get, that's my way into her somehow. Mm-hmm. You know, she just wants to do what she wants to do. And she doesn't want to be defined by anything, by anyone. And that sort of strong sense of subjecthood is what defines Dana to me more than any sort of affinity or identifier. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I think I've been looking for more characters like that just in general for Black women, because I know we all like tote Issa Rae for, you know, kind of changing the game on what Black women look like in film and TV. Like, you can hate us too, but still respect us and things like that. Mm-hmm. But it's like the idea of Black women in the nuance. That's what I want to see. I myself am not put in all the kind of boxes that Black women are always put in. So then when you approach or are received in a room, either people don't get you, you don't fit somewhere, so you've got to go, or you're ignored, that kind of thing. And writing characters that live in the nuance allows you to be seen anywhere. You know what I mean? Right. Even if you're saying it's television or something like that, but like that is what changes people's perspective on what Black womanhood really is. Yeah.
And that idea of like, they don't get it, that is Dana to me. She's like, they don't, no one gets it. In the show, no one gets it. No one believes her. No one can wrap their head around why she made the choices she made, except for her. And then she looks crazy to some people.
Right.
She looks uppity to some people, you know, but she's just being herself.
Exactly.
You know, and I think also, you know, and this is why I think I populated, you know, you might notice that the episodes are kind of named after all these, have all these women's names, but, you know, I wanted to not have the burden of like Black every woman be on Dana. Like I wanted people to, that I wanted like a prismatic gallery of people who could like fight and argue and sort of just be in contention with each other. That was like the desire the whole time. So hopefully she doesn't have, you know.
Yeah.
And also we had, by the way, like the room was majority Black women. Like we, you know, we just, I just tried, you know, they're just everywhere in the show and I begged them to keep me honest. So that's part of it. You know, I don't know. I try to be very selfless or something in this process. Like, cause again, I'm only doing this cause of Octavia Butler. You know, I just, I don't know. I just feel like it's a shared experience in some ways making the show. And
absolutely.
That's quick testimonial. Yeah. My mother is from Byhalia, Mississippi. And this version of Kindred was wild for me because outside of the show, outside of the tapestry of the show itself, just the characters, Olivia reminds me of who my mom was forced to be. And Dana, I really feel like my mom wanted to be Dana.
Mm.
But you know, the world wasn't like that.
Right. Mm.
And
that's wild.
It just, yeah, so there's that interplay was, to watch that interplay happen, it's going to open a lot of conversation and dialogue.
Yeah.
I hope so. I really hope so.
Well, I'm going to workshop it, and I'm going to teach it, and it's going to have that dialogue.
Force the dialogue!
So dialogue is happening.
Oh, man.
It got real deep at the end there. Very appreciative of that.
I mean, listen, this is what nerds do.
Yeah.
This is what we be doing. Well,
thank you so much. I was going to ask you, what is your nerd, but I think we talked about it the whole time. If it's not Watchmen and X-Men and all that, then I don't know.
Well, it's this thing now called, well, it's so funny because I was asked to prepare this. My nerd right now is a show called Alone.
Oh my God. That's my company's History, Lifetime,
and Amy. That's hilarious. Yeah, no, that is like my, I think I've converted more people in the state of New York to watching that show than any other thing. Like, that show is everything to me. It's just like, it's the only reality show where I've like literally, it has changed my life. Like I've taken life lessons from it into my life.
If you don't know what Alone is, it's where like they put someone alone in the wilderness. Yeah, 10
people are like dropped off in this wilderness. They're separated from each other. They were given cameras and it's like the last person standing wins X amount of money.
Yeah.
Oh. But what happens is like, for a while it's just like skill set and who's afraid of like bears or shit. They're the people who flee. But then something happens like halfway through the show with the people who stay, they start to like, the battle starts to become like inward and you see people have like actual spiritual experiences and
breakdowns.
I find it so moving.
Oh,
I cry every finale.
Is that where the guy had the heart attack and all that stuff?
Yeah. Well, he didn't have a heart attack. He had had a heart attack before.
Yes, and he was freaking out.
He thought he was having another one. Yeah.
I caught a glimpse of the show. It looked intense.
Yeah,
it's intense. It's worth it, guys. It's worth it.
Yeah, no, we're making up. We're thinking about making a podcast off of it. So a lot of the podcast department is taking the shows and making them podcasts. So that's one of the ones that they're thinking about because it's got such a big following.
Please put me on that podcast.
Oh,
please.
Absolutely.
I will almost host the podcast. Like I literally, I will talk about the show forever. Ever. My friends are like, please don't talk about it alone. But then they go watch and they're like, you're right, the show's amazing. And then they want to watch it with me. I'm like, I have time to watch it with you. It's too important to me to watch it myself. But
well, hopefully I'll have a say in it because I don't do history podcasts with Lifetime and A&E, but
oh my goodness.
I talk with them every day. So I'll be like, listen, I have someone for you.
give it up.
Thank you so much for coming, Brandon. We will all be watching Kindred. Please look out for it. This is probably airing after the premiere. So catch it. It releases on Tuesdays on Hulu, FX. Watch Kindred. Tell all your friends so that we can have a season two because the story needs to keep going.
And just play it in the background while your family's cooking Christmas dinner. That's fine, too.
Absolutely.
Yeah, put it on, like, repeat.
Literally, it's for repeat. All right. Thanks, guys. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Wow. That was really great.
It was.
I mean, above anything else, it was really nice to just talk to Brandon for a little bit.
Yeah, it's dope to catch up with your homies, especially when your homies are out here in the world doing these amazing things. But yeah, it's just a great conversation about it. I didn't think we were going to go as far as we did into all the things that we did.
Well, I know. Well, I think it's like when you haven't seen someone in a long time, too, and it's like they're doing the same stuff that you love to talk about. It was like, okay, we're at time. And he's like, no, wait. Can we keep talking?
More.
And you're like, yeah. I mean, I want to keep talking, of course. I do want to know what people were saying about the two not being married. I think that was...
Yeah.
I want to know the juicy gossip.
Like, why is that controversial? Why is it hitting? Why is it hitting primarily with folks who were, like, you know, diehards of the book?
Right. Well, I mean, I feel like there's always that one thing that's like, you can't change this. It's in the book. You know, but at the same time, if we're saying this is current times, I feel like it makes sense for them not to be married because, I mean, I'm not a statistician. I think that's a real job.
Word. It's hard to be
where they look at statistics.
The idea that the situationship was the thing. You can't be in a situationship and can't be OD married and be in a situationship. It kind of changes
the
bond. So, yeah, like, exactly where I'm underscoring what you were saying.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I'm not a statistician, but I feel like the amount of millennials who are, like, not getting married these days is much higher than, you know, back then when Octavia wrote the book. And so, you know, people are like, I don't need to be married. I don't want to have kids. It's a big thing.
I mean, that too. But then we live in a world, we've watched all these adaptations of other things already happen, wildly change things, but still have the same impact, you know, in cultural relevance. So I'm like, all right, you can do that.
Yeah. Well, had lots of fun. And we have a lot in store for this podcast for this season. So I really hope you guys are listening and keep listening because we're going to be talking to people like the creators of Black Nerd Problems, also friends of ours, but also like some writers, some actors, some people who are the actual creators of the things that we love. So
we're not saying no names. You're going to have to be surprised.
Be surprised. And we'll probably take a break for the holidays, you know, because we got Christmas coming up and then the New Year's. Blah, blah, blah. So catch us back in 2023 with episode 2 and beyond. And beyond plus ultra. Listen, y'all, I know it sounds like we have a whole team behind us, but this podcast is actually produced by the two of us, Aisha Jordan
and France Jerome.
But we do have some help from our sound mixers at Wild Horses Recording.
Big shout outs to Daryl, Minnesota. What's up?
Hey. And obviously, this would not be possible without our listeners, so we love you so much.
Absolutely. So do us the favor of doing you the favor. Please subscribe, rate, review, tell a friend to tell a friend, hit the carrier pigeon, some smoke signals, a little Morse code, everything.
All of that. And we'll catch you on the next one.
Catch you on the next one.